All right. I don't think at this point need to remind everybody about the context of Tikkun Olam, but this is a Mishnah in the context of Tikkun Olam, of fixing the world, and it's not going to say so explicitly. So, a reminder. The Perek, since the chapter, since it's dealing with such a reality of legislation that responds to the needs of the day, is going to deal with a different issue. We're going to start a new Mishnah, and I'm going to ask you to open to 37b2. So I'm on page Lamed Zayin Amud Bet of our Masechta, Gittin. Happens to be that Gittin is now the tractate being studied in the daily daf cycle, in the study around the world. There's a lot of talk about the tractate. And I was able to today to recommend that there are many texts within our chapter that we've been studying here in the Beit Midrash. I was able to recommend some texts today to Tal Becker, who's here in town from Shalom Hartman Institute, and who has been at the negotiating table for Israel with the Palestinians and is privy to many conversations among those from all points of the circle. If there is a center, who knows what the center really looks like, but all the different angles and sides, and especially the notion of this chapter relating to, you know, when does a community look at itself and really change? When does a community face its own problems? When does a community face its own hang-ups? When does a community face its claims to truth? How does a claim to truth that is an abiding, you know, among the verities, let's say, in a community that we want to make sure stay at the center of the narrative, how do you do that but still work with other people's narratives? In other words, you want to say that anybody can give a divorce decree, a get, to a wife, but you also want to realize that there are some husbands who will just be jerks about it. And you want to talk about validating documents before a court, and you want to get past just making a mark with a pen, and you want to have people sign their names, because you want this to be a system that takes responsibility very seriously. And today we're going to encounter some texts that I thought would be very interesting in terms of the dialogue among Jewish people today, how we can really sit and understand that there's a multiplicity of perspectives that we had to deal with in the time of the rabbis concerning one of the potentially, and I'll use the word potentially because I'm going to drush that out later, but central issues of the Torah, and that is the system of slavery that the Torah suggests that we engage, or that the Torah once had us engaging and now has us looking at and saying, well, wait a minute, how do we do this? Do we do this at all? Do we have slaves in our precincts? Do we have some sort of eved, some sort of servant? And this Mishnah is going to come, and it's going to be not only apodictic law, codific law about what we do with slaves who need to be redeemed, taken captive by others outside the Jewish community. And the issue of redeeming captives is a very, very central one for us, in the sense that we always make sure to redeem those who are captive and bring them back to the community. But I think the Gemara is really pressing the question, is this a system that you want Jewish people in the time that you live in this empire, the Roman Empire, in your land or in a diaspora? Is this really something you're going to engage systemically? Is this really a social construct? Is this really a social enterprise that you really want to continue? And I think the Gemara doesn't say that so explicitly, but I believe that this whole chapter is really asking ad kedei kach, that far. I believe the chapter is going that far in this case, but particularly in this subject area, to say, really, are you going to have this? So, by way of background, remember that the Torah provides for a system of indentured servitude. Right? 6 years. Mentioned last week that at the seventh year, right, the indentured servant, the Eved Ivri, as the institution, has to declare that he wants to stay with the master if he doesn't go free. And then there's that ceremony, and to the door, and they put with an awl through the ear, and there's a mark that, wow, you're really giving yourself over to this human master, and that to me is a ceremony that says you have to think really critically before you decide to just stay around. But this notion of freeing the Eved Ivri, if one doesn't get freed at year seven, the system allowed for that servant to stay, but by the Jubilee year, which is the 50th year, that person had to go free. So there was a complete forgiveness at that point if the person, let's say, was an Eved, was an indentured servant, for the debt that he might have owed any master, that we had to invoke the Jubilee year and say, okay, that's Dror Yikra, that we would proclaim a full freedom for those people. So that's the background biblically. Also, if I said slavery in terms of Torah, what else would come to mind? Most might think about Havadim Hayinu. Most might think about the Passover tale, and that it is a central part of the narrative in very Jewish historical kind of way, but particularly for the rabbis who make that a central feature in what a Jewish person will relate to in the holiday cycle, making Pesach so much about Avadim Hayinu. Making Pesach so much about a midrashic read of a paragraph in Deuteronomy, by the way, where my father was a wandering Aramean and then ultimately became enslaved to Pharaoh, and he was crushed with labor that was intense and demeaning to the point where he needed to be freed from his slavery, right? But I'll just bid you to remember that it is the Haggadah and the strong read of the Midrash that makes slavery so central, and that is a rabbinic enterprise. Because there's a way of looking at Exodus when we begin to read the whole story of the Yiridah to Mitzrayim, the going down to Egypt. There's a way to read that does not necessarily say on its face, in the simple level, on the pshat level, that the Jewish people were enslaved by Pharaoh. There were crushing labors placed upon them for the work they did within society. But the institution, if you will, of slavery, per se, is not necessarily an Exodus principle or an Exodus kind of construct.
Really?
And what's amazing about that is if you read it with those spectacles this year, you'll tell me if you agree or you disagree, but you'll be in dialogue with a way of reading Exodus that is not as rabbinic as the book of Exodus may be itself, a place to say that there was an empire and a leadership that little by little demanded more of a people who ultimately cried out, there's a potential for being crushed here, as opposed to a complete slavery, as we understand a slavery of either the mindset we come in with Westerners and the American scene, with the African-American and enslavement of people of color, or slavery in the age of the Romans. And the rabbis want to highlight it in the Haggadah as absolute slavery, because potentially they have to grapple with this institution that they've allowed to fall into Jewish hands. Because there is a potential that for the biblical period, the ongoing nature of indentured servitude, a la Eved Ivri, was done several centuries before the Hellenistic and Roman Palestinian era, when the institutions of slavery come back and are redefined in antiquity. There is a possibility that slavery, as in the Bible, ended and a certain number of centuries passed before the Jewish people encountered a Hellenistic and a Roman Palestinian system of slavery, and then themselves adopted that way of life. And the rabbis are self-reflective enough. Texts that are central to our identities ask the question, the Haggadah, this Mishnah we're about to read. Slavery? Really? Are we supposed to have slaves? Are we supposed to free slaves? Redeem a slave? Narratives in rabbinic texts, rabbinic midrash, texts from this age, Josephus included, the historical texts that we can come up with from this age, the Hellenistic, Roman, rabbinic period, they are going to relate to any number of laws that are the laws of holding slaves for Jewish people. They're going to parallel laws of slavery in the Roman body of law. And we're going to make a little bit more of a push to consider the moral questions that come up with slavery, not only here in the Gemara, but in these side texts that exist from that time, that challenge the notion, for instance, of what a master does with a woman who's a slave. Does he have free rein to bed her, create more children through her, and frankly abuse her sexually? The Jewish reflection on such behavior is to try to limit that, both within what look like laws about having house slaves, because as Jews urbanized, they did have more domestic slaves than agricultural ones, and they had slaves of Canaanite origin. They called them Eved Kanaani, but are they Canaanites as in the biblical era? No. It's a category of servant and slave that they had within their precincts, non-Jewish, who were circumcised and brought into the home and had certain positive obligations vis-a-vis cultural norms that Jewish people would hold, Sabbath, for instance. So we're left with a scenario where Jewish reflection on the institutions and Jewish reflection on the cultural practices and norms that Romans used vis-a-vis their slaves were those with which the writers of certain texts are in dialogue. We're looking to make it a more moral approach, yet the system in and of itself exists. I think there's a deep question within the text of the Gemara itself as to whether or not the institution at all should just be nullified, you'd expect from the most enlightened direction, maybe a mipnei tikkun olam, for the sake of fixing the world. What?
Abolish.
We just won't have it. We'll abolish it. But that's not what's going on in the normative culture here around them, especially within that Roman Empire, where, you know, depending on your scholar, some people say 7 million, 8 million, upwards of 13 million Jews are scattered from Sasanian Persia through to the homeland in Italy. So this is a very big question by way of society and our encountering the social construct of Dut in the time that it exists in this classical world. So that, I think, is an important context to remember. A lot of that, for those interested, a lot of that information is summarized in a wonderful chapter, chapter 20 of the Cambridge History of Slavery. And Catherine Hesser is the author there who wrote the chapter 20 called Slavery and the Jews. And I believe a 2009 first edition.
Recently.
Oh yeah, very recently. She's a published scholar in the field of slavery from end of the 90s through 2005, 7. Some of her newer articles have come out recently.
Okay, what's your family name again?
H-E-Z-S-E-R.
Thank you.
I'll actually get back to some of it, and I'm going to read you some quotes from that chapter.
Clarify, though, the difference in time between Jews as slaves in Egypt and Roman time. How many years is there between them?
Oh, you're talking 1,500 years.
So, you'll explain further, I'm sure, how the Jewish practice of keeping Jewish slaves is any way like the Egyptian practice of...
I'm not going to get into very much of that because
I don't see how those are necessarily related.
Well, the only in the sense that in the historical annals, in the remembrances of the Jewish people, right, we remember that Pharaoh enslaved us. Whether that was a complete enslavement like the Romans have house slaves and agricultural slaves from other empires.
We do know some details about how we were enslaved and what things we were not allowed to do and how things
right.
got harder.
So
we have some very specific descriptions of
right, so we experienced that in whatever ways that it was described. And one might think, with all the times the Torah says, don't oppress the stranger because you were a stranger in a strange land, the verse that's most often repeated in the Torah, that we would completely have abolished such oppression, right? That if we experienced that oppression, we wouldn't have had it. Well, when we get into the land of Israel, though, we have the Torah that tells us that we can have indentured servants, Eved Ivri. We also have Eved Kanani. We have non-Jewish slaves, some whom we take from battle, and some whom we simply have as those who live in our precincts, who become known as having the status of Eved. In year 6, the Hebrew slave is to be released. That's really not a slave in a certain sense of the word that we use with the Western sensibility we have. That's an indentured servant. That is already very different from Egypt. The Eved Kanani is also different. Because what you're doing is you're saying, I'm going to take you into my household, and I'm going to be required by law to actually allow you some space to live in a Jewish cultural way. My worry is that you will bring your idolatry and your paganism into my precincts. So the rabbis from an early age, if they inherited anything, they inherited cultural laws, norms, and what have you, from the biblical time, or they kind of adopted new ways of looking at how do you do this so that you can create cultural hegemony through your own movement, through rabbinic eyes, through the rabbinic ways that they have at their disposal. They're going to create rules and norms that say about those servants, okay, your status is different, but you still have to behave like us. That is a very different way of looking at slaves than the crushing Assyrians who might have had their certain servant class, or you have a sense that certain peoples need to be completely just made into captives of war kind of slaves and do our building projects. That's not exactly the system we're talking about. So we're differentiating ourselves from any potential burdening of slaves or beating of slaves like we think about Pharaoh doing, or like we think about, as I said, in terms of the Western world of enslaving people. There were slave markets. People were movable property. That piece, though, is very real. That's attested to within several of the texts that we talked about. But again, we would hope that there is a real sense that the cultural inclusion or including people within the societal norms in whatever way, even if their status was of property of the home and not fully Jewish in their status, that differentiated them from, let's say, a pharaoh who was completely evil and worked them to the bone and bloodied them.
Just one question, since we've discussed this for a good long while. I'll just ask one question. It would be sort of a litmus test for me. Do we have any evidence, maybe the wrong word, do we know where the halakha, does it permit a Jewish owner of, in effect, if I own a male slave and he's married and has children, mm-hmm. do I, by necessity, I own all of them? Or is my ownership only of the man? I own the family? Okay. Does halakha permit me to sell them off piecemeal, or do I need to maintain the family unit? Do I respect the fact that there's a family?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because I thought of the same question in my research. For sure, our Gemara doesn't talk about it.
I'm tempted sometimes to think that there may have been an innocuous aspect to this, given the fact that they're living in very different times, and I wonder, do we know, you know, is it possible this is no different than families nowadays who have, you know, a nanny, and back then, of course, may not have made as much sense to be going home at night, but doesn't mean that there's not actually a good relationship between the people.
I think we would...
Sell off the family.
Right. I think we'd be moving towards apologetica if we talked about it in the nanny format. But I also asked that question too, as I was considering this Gemara for the last week. I imagine that some people came from very destabilized societal structures, and they found themselves within the stable societal structure of the Jewish community, and then they joined in, and they left families behind, and they left their societies behind. Now, you could say that that's problematic from the sense that there's just not a great place for them to have created their own cultural normative lives in their own nations. It's kind of like, frankly, I lived in Jerusalem, I lived with a family, they had 9 children, it was in the center near the market district, and there was a very poor woman from Poland who lived in the house away from her family for all the years that I know them. You know, she's basically a permanent fixture there. And she gets to live in that space and in that room, and she's not Jewish, and she does everything in that house that you would think a house servant would do, right? So is that something she willfully once agreed to?
Because she was not paid, she just got room and board.
I'm sure she got paid something. In Israel, you cannot do that. You will go to jail if you...
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the religious community, there are lots of different ways that people incorporate people into the system.
I believe you. The religious people in Israel are
and they write it into their plan for how the yeshiva works that they're building in their home. And so, you know, with hope that the authorities do not allow for complete indentured servitude or other types of servitude, I just don't want to go so far as to say I'm not suspect of the system. I don't think it's just a nanny system.
No, I'm not trying to paint a rosy picture.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is we're trying to differentiate between what we know about what happened in this country in terms of slavery. And I'm just wondering whether this system, for some people, was not onerous, but fits into the economy of the time in a way that strikes us as strange, if we're going to use words like indentured servitude. But I'm saying, if I'm able to go selling off a husband, wife, and their children separately, then that
right.
You know, gives me much more reason to be very suspect of
the Jewish owner of
slaves.
In a Jewish owner of slaves, the children are not the slave. They are not ownership of the master, but the master needs to treat him like his own children, educate them, and take care of their clothing.
I need to respect them. It tells me something if I need to respect that family as opposed to four pieces of property.
So there's a Tel Aviv University professor who has been making great waves, who says there never was an Exodus, but that the time period we're talking about is when the Hittites and the Egyptians fought, and they fought throughout the land of Canaan. And that the Hebrews, who were called, how do you say it, Rabbi Hebrew? Can I say it something? Hebrew. They were really in the hills, and they were marauders. And that they were caught up in all of that, and that they did experience the heavy hand of Egypt still in sort of the hills of Canaan, and that's really what our whole Exodus story is about. And there's no way to prove anything about this, as everything and everyone understands, but since there's no archaeological evidence of Jews being
in Egypt.
Right, there's nothing in Egypt that has an archaeological basis to the Exodus. It gives scholars impetus to try to understand what may have happened. Because clearly, it's in the national psyche, so there's a reason it's there, and that's what they respect. But why? Yeah. Where did it come from? So I think it's a very interesting field of thought. And about slavery, though, so we have this impression that the Egyptian great buildings were built by slaves, that the great buildings of Babylon were built by slaves, and we now know that probably is not true. Contemporary scholarship is almost in agreement that it was built by corvée, which means every one of us would have had to give a certain amount of time every year to working on the buildings on behalf of the state or the palace. Let's not get hung up.
That's why the ten tribes left King Solomon, because he wanted them to
build
the temple. That was the reason they joined the king of the
north. Here we have archaeological evidence that in those sites, outside of the buildings, massive, massive amounts of cow bones. Massive. And so what it says to the scholars is that these were parties. They worked hard, but they partied. They were fed well, they drank well, and that this was a sought-after time of the year for all of us, because we left our villages, or we left our homes, and we went and we engaged in a greater communal good, and we had a good time. And that is what contemporary scholarship believes, how all the pyramids were built, Babylon, the ziggurats, and it's, I mean, you read the...
In Persia, too? Ziggurats.
Sorry?
That sounds a little bit optimistic
to me. No, it was compulsory labor.
Yeah, exactly.
It's compulsory, but it's not slavery.
To
right.
Say this, I mean, how did they decide this after all?
No, it was not sudden. This way of thought has been developing now over probably the last 50 years.
And
this
the
scholarship.
Evidence is?
The evidence is texts in cuneiform texts, papyrus texts. And it's also from now the massive archaeological discoveries of why do you have such unusually large amounts of very expensive food stuff remnants left outside all the building sites.
Yeah.
Some of it's also lack of evidence. In wandering in the desert for 40 years, 600,000 people, 300,000 people,
There should be something, some campsite, something that someone would have found over the last 100 or 200 years. And the fact that they haven't been found with modern technology seems to say that that's probably not what happened. Mm-hmm. So let's look at alternatives to make sense with everything else. And it's still evolving.
Yeah, I mean, there is a great piece in the current issue of Mosaic magazine, which provides evidence to the contrary, which is in dialogue with all of this, which talks about, I have it sitting on my Stender to read, I haven't read it yet, but it was in 2 days ago, you could click on the link, evidence for the Exodus, or, you know, did the Exodus really happen? David Wolpe said it didn't happen, these scholars are working on this theory. Here are the pieces of evidence we have that absolutely this could have been a caravan. There weren't massive camps. People were good about taking.
It was 20 people.
Yeah. Numbers aside, the numbers in the Bible are not really, you know, they are, and they're used for purposes of it. You couldn't really tell looking at them quickly how many were there. The 600,000 number is really a number that says. So, okay. You know, what's interesting, I was just looking through this again, back to Jay's question, because I want to push into the text. I didn't remember that anybody really related to the question, and I just verified it. And there's no one who really related to the question about exactly the status of the children, except to say that we, in rabbinic times, there was the sense that children of slaves are slaves, and it goes by the mother's status. And you have texts about the market, but you don't really have great narratives of dragging a family to the market and all the kinds of horror stories. Of course, we don't have the slave narratives, right? And so I don't think we really know what was exactly happening at the time. There was a sense that they were looking to lessen the amount of jealousy that would occur between a wife in a family and the slave wives and then the offspring. That is what has come through, and you can read more about where she quotes from. You can read more about that and how that comes through. And I think for the reason that we know that gets very complicated. And well, you have all kinds of biblical precedents for actually handing over handmaidens, slave wives, and that's what they're reacting against. And the texts that talk about this kind of, you know, cleaning things up, really do relate to those exact situations. Let your young men or reaching the age of wedlock marry virgins freeborn and of honest parents. Female slaves must not be taken in marriage by free men, however strongly some may be constrained thereto by love. Such passion must be mastered by regard for decorum and the properties of rank. And that's in Antiquities, that's in Josephus. Now, you have to ask all the time about Josephus. What is he trying to represent? But he would have no real reason before the Romans to say that they're such moralists in this case, because he's also trying to say, hey, your law, Roman emperors, seemed to be the law that they followed for this. He could have said that very much the same way he's saying anything in reporting about the scenarios. But that is verified within Midrashic literature as well, where the reaction against someone saying that God, in Leviticus Rabbah, in a Midrashic text, the reaction against God, someone saying God is the only one who really makes couples, this person breaks out of their normative moral behavior and goes to the slave familia, the slave family that they own, and starts coupling the different slaves and couples some of the slaves with free men and free women, as if to say this is completely rebellious behavior against God and against human beings. So this notion is written up in Josephus, it's written up in our text in Leviticus Rabbah, and so that's really the...
It happens in People magazine, too. It happens with the au pairs, you know, it happens today.
No doubt about it.
You know, under the same roof.
Yeah, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. So, okay, let's push into this Mishnah and see, like, at least...
I thought it was vanity fair. Now lower. Elevated.
Okay. So let's look at this Mishnah. We're talking about Eved Kanaan meat. The status of... It's 37b2. We're talking about a Mishnah that talks about when a Jew's Eved Kanaani, a Canaanite slave, is taken captive. Okay? And again, the Canaanite slave as a category is one that becomes the property of a master, and the child born to that Canaanite slave woman belongs to the master. He's circumcised when he's purchased and supposed to be immersed in a mikveh, which is a ritual bath, and he then becomes a slave. Notion is that he has the same obligations as a woman in the bigger picture of Jewish law. So what does that mean? It means that you don't really have a lot of the mitzvot ase shezem on grama. You don't have time-bound positive mitzvot, and which mitzvot actually fit into that category, though, remember, is very loose. And the reason I tell you that now is because for the purposes of this conversation, just remember that prayer for the rabbis, though everybody's obligated in general to prayer, making a minyan becomes a different story than prayer itself, and prayer and making the minyan is in a more mitzvah asay, a positive mitzvah shez mangrama, that the time is actually fixed. And for that, we'll need that information later when we get to a little maisel, a little story about what happens with a slave. Okay. Meanwhile, into the Mishnah. Eved shenishba ufedauhu. If a Jew's Canaanite slave was taken captive and others ransomed him, and you see the bracket there, it says other Jews. Yeah, it's to be assumed, but it doesn't say it. The slave status is now going to be discussed. Im l'shum eved yishtabed, if they ransom that slave to be a slave, he's enslaved. Im l'shum ben chorin lo yishtabed, but if they ransomed him to be a free man, he's not enslaved. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel omer, but Shimon ben Gamliel comes and says, ben kach uven kach yishtabed. Whether he's freed with this intention or that intention, he's got to still be a slave. So now the question is, what's the fix? Just reading the Mishnah, what's Shimon ben Gamliel's fix? Why is that a fix? How is that a fix?
Because if you could... finagle the whole thing to get your freedom.
Exactly.
I mean, it takes some effort. But you still
so how are you going to finagle? Give me the case. Play out the case, Laura.
I have a buddy. I make a buddy in town. I'm a slave, but I take the cart to the market every week, and I make a friend with Fred, and I get Fred to kidnap me, and then I get Fred's buddy to say, okay, we're going to ransom him, and then it's freedom. I mean, obviously, I'm going to have to pay it back, so I'm still going to be in an indentured form of servitude, but I mean, it doesn't make any sense that you would ransom some slave to be a free person.
So that's what Shimon ben Gamliel is worried about.
And we know that that kidnapping and ransoming was extraordinarily common.
Right.
Why pedao, it's ransom, and not releasing from that somebody buys him out and free?
Because we're in the context here.
So So they're using maybe the wrong word, or I understand.
Well, this is the Mishnaic word about
Lifdot is not to redeem. Only ransom. Lifdot is to release from other obligations through money.
Here, we're not talking about Mishachrer, and we're not talking about financial obligations. In the context of the Mishnah, we know this is the direction. Okay. And you're talking about Rashi, filling that in, if you have no other way of even knowing that, if you don't just assume it. You know, he says about Eved, it's an Eved Kanaani, Shenishba Fudarehu, Yisraelim, Acherim. Rashi fills in that was other Jewish people that went to ransom them. Okay. So the Gemara starts. But my askinan, what case are we dealing with here? Or what are, the way to really understand that question of the Gemara is what are the particulars that may come to bear that I have to be concerned about in this picture? Like, okay, Laura's gave us that case. But are there other little matters at play here that we don't really know about? Like, what's the Mishnah really addressing? What are the cases that the Mishnah is addressing? What's at play here? Okay? That's really, but my askinan. So what's at play here? Ilema lifnei ye'ush. If you say that it's before abandonment that we're talking about, ye'ush is a halachic principle. I'm going to tell you what that means in just a second. If you say that it's before abandonment, l'shum ben chorin amaylo yishtabed, then even if he was ransomed to be a free man, why is he not enslaved by his master? Since the master had no ye'ush. The master had no abandonment of hope. So we have this principle in this whole notion of a slave that gets taken captive, that if I, as the master, give up hope that my slave is ever going to be returned to me, then I can say that I have this ye'ush, I make that declaration, and anyone who wants to go redeem him now is doing a nice thing by redeeming him, but not necessarily bringing him back to me as the master. He's no longer my property. Okay. That's when Ela la'achar ye'ush, and if you say rather that it really was that he was ransomed after this abandonment, l'shum eved ama yishtabed, for then, what, right? If he was ransomed to be a slave, why is he enslaved? So if you had ye'ush, right, and you said basically that this person is going to be redeemed, why is he enslaved?
Whoever paid may have paid to have him become his slave.
Ah, so you have the person who's the redeemer. So then we have the question of what's the status of the slave vis-a-vis that redeemer. Okay, keep that in mind. Amar Abaye. Abaye says the following. Lo'olam lifnei ye'ush. In fact, when I think about the case we're dealing with, I think this Mishnah is a Mishnah that's talking about before abandonment. In other words, the master has not abandoned hope. U'lishum eved yishtabed l'rabo rishon. And the rabbi's ruling is going to apply to this case. If the slave was to be ransomed to be a slave, he is a slave back to his first master.
Even if the party paid the money?
That's right. And then what's interesting in terms of the commentary thus far is that you'll see in the Gemara that they'll point out, and we have it in Halacha, let's say that it was my slave and Bobby, you redeemed, and then you bring him back. I owe you the money that you spent redeeming him. You could, that is, on principle, part of the law. Now, you can call that, in Jewish law, a principle like Zakin la'adam shelo bifanav. You can do something meritorious for a person without really asking the person first. So if it would be to the benefit of that person. So you're not going to hold me to five times the amount that normative ransoming would happen, because you have a moral obligation to do this both for this Eved and because I'm your brother. Now, could you get someone who abuses the system? Yeah.
Didn't we discuss this when we were talking about the courtyards? And there was value to be returned.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, from chapter 16 of Shabbat. That is, whether or not whether or not there were vessels in
right.
this courtyard,
right.
and whether or not they were all going to be vessels that you had to save and remove from the fire that broke
right.
out,
right. Right. Right.
and if you could sell them back
right.
or not, right?
Right. Right?
And you'd then get value for those vessels.
Right.
That was in chapter 16 of Shabbat. And whether or not someone would actually charge you the right amount or charge
right.
you above the right amount, that was part of the whole big question. Right, so yeah, you have to have a certain kind of moral... You have to, right, you have to have a certain kind of moral obligation towards doing the right thing in this sense.
Right.
Now, if, though, you ransomed him towards being a Ben-Horin, Lashum Ben-Horin, but if he was ransomed to be a free man, Lo Yishtabed Lo L'Rabo Rishon V'Lo L'Rabo Sheni. He's neither a slave to the first master or to the one who redeems him. Now, how or why is that so? L'Rabo Sheni Lo, he's not enslaved by his second master, the Halashum Ben Horin Parke, for the second master ransomed him to be a free man, never intending to actually take him into his possession, to own him. L'Rabo Rishon Nami Lo, and he is not enslaved by his first master, but Abaye said what? That he never lost hope. Dilma mamin e velo parke. For if the first master, right, would be permitted to have him back in his domain to reclaim him, perhaps people might refrain from actually redeeming slaves. Right? So if I know that I'm going to try to redeem him. Now, here is where I want to stop and return to my introductory kind of remark and claim that the question here is an incredible question of the Gemara. Because I think...
They want to maintain the system.
On the one hand, there seems like a desire to be maintaining whatever system and returning slaves to their status as chattel, and they are property. On the other hand, within the context of this discussion already, what's the possibility? That the Redeemer wants to what?
Freed.
That the Redeemer wants to see that he's a Ben-Horin.
But what benefit the Redeemer gets?
The question. Thus far, I can't answer you unless I tell you what the Gemara is going to talk about soon. I don't want to tell you what the Gemara is going to talk about soon to answer your question. But I'm going to tell you that that's the question beneath it all, I think. What possible benefit do we get the more freed slaves we have around here?
When I read this the way you explained to us, this is basically a bad relation between a slave and a master, that the slave made a coup, and this is how the Gemara is trying to correct it, so the owner will not
lose
his slave.
So maybe it is exactly this case, the bad relationship case, or this case that the slave was so conniving. So very much so, it could be. Could be that was the guy who ran off, and it wasn't a matter of bandits who took him. Remember, though, that there could be, third scenario, a group of bandits who is coming along, and this happened all the time, and bandits took this guy who was either in the marketplace, because he's a house servant,
to
actually ransom him.
Get the money?
Yeah.
Sure.
As a business.
Maybe a social reformer that goes around trying to free slaves.
Well, I want to see that. Is that apologetica? I don't know.
Well, I don't know. There are extremes in every society.
I agree with you, Bobby. And my claim is on this Gemara, since it's in the chapter on Tikkun Olam, that not only was the Tikkun to fix a system whereby someone couldn't create this kind of relationship with the local guy to kind of get the one to redeem him, and then he's going to be free, and the bandits who are going to come and do this for a business, I believe that the question inside the Gemara at some level really is what kind...
I don't think it's the rabbis doing it. I think it's someone else who's a little outside the system who may be there.
This is the rabbi's book. Remember, this is the rabbi's book.
Well, are they, would they be likely to redeem somebody, or they're just dealing with the fact that it's been done?
Well, I think, again, I think that's a piece of attention here.
Are they saying that it's a mitzvah? Is that one of our mitzvot?
It is definitely a mitzvah to redeem someone. But whether you redeem them and make them free, or you redeem them and just return property, it's both. Both of those fulfill the mitzvah.
You redeem a slave who's been taken captive, and you were given to redeem them out of the goodness of your heart. What does he then do? I mean, he's not in a position to set up shop and just open a business. I mean, is he just going to go
down and
attach himself to another?
I'm going to say that let's wait and see what the Gemara has as the first thing that that potential new freed guy could do. And I think it presents it the way it does, Jay, to answer the question. Yes.
What does he do? Yes.
Jay's question is: what set up shop? What opportunities are afforded him? Can he really become part of society? I'm hearing in your question, right? And I think the answer is
yes.
Okay. So I do think we're going to get there, and I'm going to tell you the example that they.
Abraham Lincoln.
Let's keep going. We're going to read a little bit more of this section. The Gemara presents a second resolution of this difficulty. So we're going to now, Abaye now explains the dissenting opinion of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who said, either which way, right, he's a slave. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel omer, ben kach uvein kach ishtabed, either way he's still a slave. Kasavar, here's how he thought, kasavar, a savara in the Gemara is a thought or a reasoning, right? Kashem she mitzvah liftot et b'nei chorin, kach mitzvah liftot et ha'avadim. Just as there is a mitzvah to ransom free men, so too there's a mitzvah to ransom slaves. And so, that gets back, Arthur, to your question. Is this a mitzvah? Either way, it's the mitzvah. And that's what he really feels one must do. Now, the Gemara is going to say, now Rav is going to have his say. Since Abaye said, we have to have now Rava, who's going to have a say, right? Amar Rav, lo'olam la'achar yeush. In fact, the Mishnah discusses a slave who really was ransomed after the master, the first one, gave up any hope that he was going to come back and be part of his household any longer. Ulishum eved yishtabed l'rabo sheni. And if the slave was ransomed to be a slave, he's enslaved by the second master. Okay, the guy who pays the ransom now is the master.
Not in agreement.
Right. Lashum ben Chorin, if he's ransomed to be the free man, though, putting out the possibility that we're talking about ransoming him as a free man, lo yishtabed lo l'rabo rishon v'lo l'rabo sheni. He doesn't become a slave either to the first master or the redeemer. L'rabo sheni lo. He's not enslaved by the second master, because obviously he was the one who redeemed him to be a free man. Deha l'shum ben chorin parke. L'rabo rishon nami lo. And to the first master, he's not a slave either. Deha l'acher yeyush hava. Because it occurred after the abandonment of hope that he would actually be returned to the household. Okay? Rav explains Rav Shimon ben Gamliel this way. Rav Shimon ben Gamliel omer, ben kach uvein kach yishtabed. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, in either case, he's enslaved by the original master. Kid de Chizkiyahu, for this reason, as Chizkiyah explained, the Amar Chizkiyah, Chizkiyah said, Mipnei ma amru ben kach uven kach ishtabed. Why did Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel say, in either case, that he's enslaved by his first master, in other words? Why can he be enslaved by the first master after the first master had abandoned hope for him? Shelo yehe kol echad ve'echad holechu ma'pil atzmo le'gayasot. It's a rabbinic ordinance so that each and every slave doesn't go give himself up to legions of bandits. Umafki atzmo miyad rabo. And thereby remove himself from the domination of his master. Okay? So, in other words, was Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel's tikkun, just to make the point, in Rava's eyes, it's getting out of the reshut, it's getting out of the first master's house, and then what? Being on some kind of redemption market for a second master or an alternative master.
Always freedom.
No, because Rabban Shimon Gamliel didn't say he could do it as Ben
Hori. Yeah, but if the guy wants to run out and join the bandits, he can stay with the bandits. He can be one of them.
No, because he's looking to probably, you know, in the mix. Remember, Rabban Shimon Ben Gamliel says Ben Kach Uben Kach Mishtabed.
That's in case
he's,
somebody
he's still
wants
enslaved.
To
In case somebody wants to free him, is in the Tana Kama of the Mishnah, is in the beginning of the Mishnah, right? And then he goes to freedom. But here, Rabban Shimon Ben Gamliel says the system stays, but he's enslaved either way. So that now he's going to be deterred from actually going and doing this, because he's going to be a slave anyway.
Tikkun Olam is like sometimes to improve the world, but at other times to keep order going and to keep kind of a status quo so that we don't have anything that ruptures the way things should be moving.
What we're seeing through this, right, is that we can't really have an abuse of the systems that we create. So it tries to ward off abuse of the system. You can say the equal and opposite is it keeps
the
status quo.
It's abuse of the system, but it is making the system so that it doesn't run smoothly. So, I mean, I don't know if these people being freed is a concept of abuse, but it is not the way they want things to run.
I think it's going at it a little differently, just because, first of all, our notion of slave, when you say the word, is for life. And these are really indentured servants. You're talking about a
six or seven-year
contract.
No, this is not Eved Ivri.
This is
Eved Kenani,
okay, so
who remains the property. Actually, Eved Ivri is an interesting question, whether or not they had anything like that at all. We feel at this point they don't, but maybe if some did exist because people had to give themselves over to a Jewish household because they were in debt, that maybe there were a few.
But, you know, the crux of getting away from here is redeem a slave. Okay, to redeem someone. Okay, whether he's a slave or not, you may not know at the time. Someone says, you know, you want to buy this person? It's 100 shekels. And you say, okay, I'm going to redeem this person and set him free. It's a good thing. And then it turns out he's a slave.
He was a slave.
Okay? So the question, the crux here is trying to get back to the whole idea. How do you keep that intact in terms of consistency as opposed to you don't want to do it because there's no benefit in doing it. And I think that's the construct that I think that is going down there, but just sort of to, there are property rights in here as well. And you're trying to deal with all of them, as well as the mitzvah of redeeming people, as well as property rights, which, property rights is what keeps a society going, okay, and an aspect of it. So there are a lot of conflicting things here that have to be sorted out, and that we're sorting still.
Good. Yeah, nice, bringing in the whole systematic piece.
It seems to me that what it really speaks to is their fear of, I'll call it chaos. And most people, when you say the word chaos, go to an extreme, and I'm not talking about it as an extreme. I'm just talking about it as a disruption to society so that you know, the people who are the powers that be can't control it. And what do the bandits represent? I mean, if you think about it, bandits represent chaos.
Mm-hmm.
So one of these, behind this is also we need to be able to say to the bandits, we even have rules about you bandits. And we can't outlaw bandits because, you know, we're not mighty enough to kill them all off. But we need to have some rules, and you have to play a little bit by our game. So we'll tolerate, I mean, I almost have the sense of this toleration of bandits, a little bit. Because we have some rules.
Because we pay them money to get the guy back.
Right, because we pay them money, so let them stay in business, and we acknowledge that. So, as long as it's this far, but not that far.
Interesting question as to whether or not we keep them in business, or we're dealing with the forces working against society that we really have envisioned, but I take the point that we do have rules about how we engage them is very important, and that plays out in many different halachic areas, right? So if they ask for one person by name versus if they don't, the authorities that are outside of the Jewish authorities, all these kinds of things, we're dealing with some type of societal realities that they're beyond our control, and those who oppose us and those who would even colonize us, and trying to figure out how to navigate those lines of keeping control within our society in all kinds of ways, including property rights and what we're willing to pay for, and whether or not we can handle it at all.
Well, I mean, there's a reason we're studying this in Gitima, someplace else. I mean, I don't get the sense that it's overwhelmingly about chaos, not that there wouldn't be chaos under some circumstances, but just this, I can't articulate it very well yet, but the fact that we're discussing it here and not in any place over in something strictly related to business is just these relationships, whether husband and wife, and in this case with families and slaves. I mean, there's a business aspect to it, there's a control aspect to it, but it's still all about what's functioning as family life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I do think that there are family systems at play here, right? The family system and the larger family system. And that's why you could say that this perek does exist within Gitin. And what breaks it and what will make it seem so egregious that it doesn't work internally, and what forces are working against us that we have to contend with?
The rabbis deal at all with how one determines when abandonment of hope takes place?
Mm-hmm. They did. They said that one a person has to make a declaration.
At a Beit Din, at the gate?
Again,
okay.
The exacts of that could be witnesses, could be a Beit Din.
Mm-hmm.
If I hear that and I go redeem somebody, can I actually say I heard the Baal say it, and the master say it, the Rav in this case, can I? So,
and no time frame, it's just the declaration? Is there a minimal time?
Yeah, I didn't see it about time frame.
Why would anybody do that? Why would a master declare that he's abandoned?
Maybe he doesn't want to pay for it. Maybe he's already got on to another
Evid. He doesn't want to take him back if he comes back.
He would be obliged to ransom him back.
He would be obliged to pay. If you go tell me that you redeemed my guy and you knew he was part of my household, I would owe you the money. So,
I have a question.
Yeah.
In regards to Evet Knani, you said that we circumcise him and we let him go to the mikveh. In about a woman,
right?
What kind of ceremony we do with a woman that she is Evet Knani? And if her children are Jewish because she was...
Yeah, so her children are not Jewish.
Even though she went to the mikveh?
Her children are not Jewish. Unclear as to whether or not she went to the mikveh. And the man, we know, gets circumcised and goes to the mikveh.
So, when we go to war, and I killed the husband of my enemy, and I took his wife to be my property, my obligation through the Talmud is to give her 30 days to mourn the husband,
right,
and then she is my wife.
Right.
And then she is Jewish. So, what is the difference?
That's called Eishet Yofet Toar, right? That is a woman who has this, she becomes beautiful in your eyes.
Right.
And you take her in as a captive of war. We're talking, yeah. And so then you're talking about,
so I don't see any difference here. How come
having
her
into
Jewish
the community?
The slave is not Jewish. It's parallel.
Yeah, it's not.
Why is the circumcision necessary?
It's pretty one topic at a time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, let me just relate to this.
The same thing. Both of the same thing.
So nobody's Jewish. Neither the man nor the woman.
So what's the circumcision part?
Unless I make this person my wife. And that's a very different kind of construct than having her stay in the status of Eved. But when I have an Eved Kanani, a non-Jewish slave, a non-Jewish servant, they are not fully Jewish. Why do I circumcise and have the person do tevila? Why do I do that? I do that because at the core of the system, I'm fundamentally worried that they will bring their culture, their idolatry, and their way of doing, let's say, time, holiday, and worship business in my precincts. I then say that they have the obligations of mitzvot that women have upon them, but they don't, and they're not, they don't count as, they are not Jewish.
Not for Romanian.
So that's now where I'm going to answer your question. What did they actually get to do? Could they make their way into society? I believe the minyan is the symbolic way that there's a gateway to freedom, a gateway to taking on a fullness of the Torah, the obligations of society, and that they show time and again through some stories that they move people from the status of Eved Kanani into the community through such a move of making them Jewish. But wait a minute. We're going to figure out now through these Gemaras that we're going to look at, one here in Gittin, and we're going to probably pick up with the one from the parallel from Brachot next time. We're going to see, what does it mean to actually allow them to count? How do we do that? Can we move somebody out of this status of Eved into the status of member of the community? And do I need to necessarily ransom them? Or can I do it in some other way? Right? And so the Gemara starts to, in this case, given everything else the Gemara says elsewhere too, gives you other ways of actually doing it. But here, as the one exemplary kind of move that Rav makes within the context of this discussion of the institution of slavery, I think it's very telling that they're kind of looking at it as, guys, look, you need to fill up a prayer quorum. You need to have a community of people with whom you can do dvarim b'kedusha. You need to have things that you do in holiness, and you know, it's, whether it's saying the Baruch Hu or Kaddish or the Kedusha and the Amida. How can you possibly be sitting there and think of your community as having people who count in the minyan and who are slaves? And so that's, again, the question. Are you going to redeem this person as a slave to be enslaved again, or towards his freedom, and look at what you could accomplish if you actually thought about this institution in a different way, as if it was a pathway into being a full-fledged member of the community. Turn to page 38B1.
38?
38B1. Now it starts off quoting, I'm on the word gufa. Okay, so
Amar Rav Yehuda.
Gufa, the text itself stated the following. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Rav Yehuda says in the name of Rav Shmuel, Kol HaMeshachrer Avdo Over Ase. Wait a minute, I just might think that anyone who emancipates his Canaanite slave, in other words, this servant living with you, that you're transgressing, you're over on a mitzvah ase. How do we say that? That you are foul by the Torah. It's a positive mitzvah to have this Eved Kanani. Once you have an Eved Kanani, you don't give him any kind of gift just like this, right? Because we have a pasuk in Devarim, by the way, that people are basing this on, that says, like, you know, don't just give him anything b'chinam. Don't just give a free gift to this non-Jewish slave. Shneamar la'olam b'hem ta'avodu. It's stated regarding Canaanite slaves, you shall work them forever. Okay. But the Gemara now comes and says, wait a minute, do I really hold that? I'm going to work them forever? I'm going to have this institution of slavery forever? That's the kind of trope that I'm seeing here. Meitave. Students bring a braita, not just an Amoraic statement, but they're going to challenge this notion with a braita, right, with a Tanaitic source, the early layer of the rhetorical material that I've got in to have this discussion. Maaseh b'Rabbi Eliezer, there was once an incident with Rabbi Eliezer, shenichnas b'veda knesset, he went into a shul, v'lo matza asara, and didn't find 10 to make the prayer quorum. V'shichrer avdo v'hishlimo la'asara. And he freed that Eved Kanani, he freed that servant who had the Eved Kanani status, was not a Jew, and he actually filled up the minyan and he created the quorum that he needed for the prayer service. Now this obviously...
He freed him permanently or just...
He freed him!
For a short period of time.
Ah, so it doesn't say for a short period of time.
Maybe just for 7 days he...
You know, I once heard a discussion in a Beit Midrash about that. Like, oh, but he didn't free him for the whole time. He only did it for the service.
For the service. That's what I thought.
Ah, but wait a minute. The Gemara answers, mitzvah shane. The fulfillment of a mitzvah is different. Although one may not ordinarily emancipate a slave, he may do so if he will thereby fulfill a mitzvah. Now, is that saying forever, or is it only saying for the moment?
We need a minyan.
Or maybe just for minyans.
Well, that's what So I don't think I don't think reading the Gemara at that point you can see
not forever.
I don't think though that you can read it and say that it's not forever.
Right.
I don't think you have to say. I don't think you're obligated to say that it's only for minions. I think that he is sitting there realizing well, that's why I said yes to Jay's bigger question, and you're. So what I'm suggesting is that what the ultimate conception here is that we know that there's got to be work for these people, because by the way, the pasuk said lo olam bahem tavodu, forever you got to work them. But if I reread that now with the conception that I've actually had a freed slave, and I've been one to Mishachrer et Avdi, that I've freed my slave, I still know that I have to provide them some kind of work forever. Maybe I'm going to pay them now to do the work that they were doing before. Maybe in the big here, I'm going to look at that human being in Minyan right now, and I'm going to say, I need a human being in Minyan, and I need a full-fledged member of the community to make a Minyan. And our community won't last unless I free my slave and make a Minyan.
Unfortunately, they've been circumcised.
Unfortunately, they've both been circumcised and the mikveh.
That's why they're circumcised.
If I wanted to be a stickler, and I was a different rabbinic authority, what's the problem I could bring up right away, noting that? Oh, but this one doesn't accept that one's circumcision, or this one doesn't accept that one's mikveh. Right? That's a problem in the Jewish world today. That's why this source comes to say, you're talking about Rabbi Eliezer, by the way, who's not even the most beloved soul, right? Who is Rabbi Eliezer? Tamid benigud le? He's always in counter-distinction to Rabbi Akiva. He's always in counter-distinction to the sages, because he's got a little bit of a different way of doing business even. And yet he's the one working here, and Akiva's going to be in the next Breita. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught in a Breita. Yeah, I'm going to wrap up with just this little bit here. Lo'olam bahem tavodu. The verse states, you shall work them forever. Divrei Rabbi Yishmael. These are the words of Rabbi Yishmael.
Lo'olam bahem tavodu reshut.
Lo'olam bahem tavodu reshut. Teaches that one has permission to purchase as a slave one born of a Canaanite mother and a non-Canaanite father. In other words, this I use for a very different kind of technical reality in terms of the slave market. Divrei Rabbi Yishmael, these are the words of Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Akiva Omer, but Rabbi Akiva says, Chova, the verse teaches an obligation to work slaves, they may not be emancipated. So he agrees with what Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel, Rabbi Akiva does. V'dilma, Rabbi Eliezer, Savar La, Kamanda Amar Reshut. And maybe I can explain Rabbi Eliezer, who thought that someone has permission to do this kind of purchase, to work that person as an Eved Kanani. Lo salkadatach, don't think so. Detanya behedya, for it was taught explicitly in a Braisa, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Chova. Rabbi Eliezer says it's an obligation to work slaves, they may not be emancipated. Since Rabbi Eliezer himself says that the freeing of slaves is forbidden, right? But I'm left with the story where Rabbi Eliezer actually did it. So even though he has a tradition that you generally don't do it, what is the time that I can free a slave?
Only for minyan.
For a minyan or for a mitzvah. Now, again, I want to take a strong read on that and say, when I realize that I've got an Eved Kenani who follows the ways of the Jewish people, who's a good, hard-working soul in my household, who's a potential member of our community for the prayer quorum and beyond, I can free him.
So the question is, if the guy wants to be a part of a minyan, and I don't want him, because this way he will not do his job, is it allowed for him?
Rabbi Eliezer chose to say yes. I can't answer for you, who has a different conception. But if there's a minyan that's necessary in my area of Jewish Hasaplus, or in Palestine, or in Bavel, and I see that this is the reality that's facing me, then I want to create the minyan, I want to create the community. Remember, the other piece about this is where there's a minyan, we're constantly looking to make sure that the minyan culture, the rabbinic culture, is ensured. And I think that this was a way in to say, maybe this is actually how we convert people. They come to work for us, we circumcise them, we put them in the mikveh, and by the way, these are good people.
Well, basically, you want to outlaw slavery.
And I think underneath it, I think that is the hope.
So both of them, you're enslaved or provide employment.
Okay.
I
think you can read it the other way, and here's the other piece that I want to do this with the other sugya, but I'll give you the foreshadowing. What else does Ta'avodu mean in our tradition? What else is Avodah?
Pray.
It's pray. It's do the work of our community before God. And I think that the work of the community before God in the Tikkun Olam sense is the abolition that comes in terms of this trope.
But does it get the...